Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Ken Miller. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Miller is an oncologist who specializes in pain and palliative care. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, we take a look at the prevention and treatment of breast cancer with Dr. Michael DiGiovanna, an associate professor of medical oncology at the Yale Cancer Center.
Mike, let's start out by talking about some of the myths that people may believe. So let me ask this one. Does breast cancer only affect women with a family history?
It certainly doesn't. So having a family history is one of the well-known risk factors for developing cancer, and many people know that the tendency to develop cancer can be genetically inherited. But actually, only about 5% of breast cancers seem to be genetically inherited, and the other 95% seem to be random and sporadic.
What would be the situations in which you'd be concerned more about a real family genetic history of breast cancer?
So the situations would be primarily if there is a first-degree relative with the cancer, and by first-degree relative we mean your mother, your sister, or your daughter. Then the next kind of factor that plays in is how many people in the family have had breast cancer. So the more people in the family that have it, the higher the odds that there is something genetically inherited in the family. Another factor is the age of onset within a family. So the average age of breast cancer striking is about 58 to 60. When it strikes in the premenopausal range, someone 40 or younger than 40, that's a tip-off that it can be genetically inherited. And finally, there are certain syndromes that run along in groups of cancer, and one of the primary ones in breast cancer is a relationship between breast cancer and ovarian cancer. And so if there are those two cancers in a family, that's a risk factor that there could be a genetically inherited syndrome.
Mike, let me ask you, talking about risk, there's something called the Gale model that can help a woman or help a doctor counsel a woman in terms of her risk. Can you tell us about the Gale model, or just, and also in general, how do you advise women about their risk?
Yeah, so the way I advise women is to go run down the list of what are primarily the risk factors for breast cancer. And I start by saying that the primary number one risk factor is being female, because almost 1 out of 8 women statistically in the United States at some point will develop breast cancer. Probably the next strongest risk factor is the one we mentioned, a family history. And then there are other risk factors that have to do with reproductive issues such as the age at which a woman first has had a child, or whether a woman has had a child or not had a child, whether a woman has breastfed, the age at which her menstrual periods began as a teenager, and the age at which she reaches menopause. And there are also some benign breast conditions that can be seen on biopsies, and some of these benign conditions can be associated with a higher incidence of breast cancer. And the Gale model, the one that you mentioned, is one of several available models that can kind of plug all of these factors into an equation and give someone their estimated risk of developing breast cancer, perhaps over the next 5 years or the next 10 years. And this is actually available online for people on the National Cancer Institute website.
Mike, we know that early detection screening is really the key for this disease. You know, at what age do you start? Do you recommend women begin, with self-exams and then having mammograms?
Yeah, so the principal screening test is mammogram, and we recommend that all women begin having mammograms at age 40. However, if there is a family history or a genetically inherited syndrome within the family, we may recommend that begin at an even younger age, perhaps 10 years younger. And as well, when there is early onset breast cancer within a family, we recommend that the other women in that family begin having mammograms at least 10 years earlier than the earliest age of onset of somebody afflicted with the cancer. So, for example, if one family member has been afflicted with breast cancer at age 35, we would recommend mammographic screening begin at age 25. The other two components of screening are the ones you mentioned, which are self-breast examination and clinical breast examination, or what we mean by that is a doctor doing a breast exam at doctor checkups. And really, all women who, once reaching adulthood, should be educated to examine their own breasts with self-breast examination at least once a month. And for premenopausal women, this should be preferably after the menstrual period has ended, because prior to that, the breasts may naturally have some lumpy consistency to them.
Mike, and let's focus a little bit on women who are at higher risk. Let's say they have one of those features that you mentioned, one of those, or a family history, et cetera. What surveillance would you – are there other forms of surveillance? MRI has been talked about. And how would their surveillance be different than a woman who did not have a risk factor?
Yes. So MRI scans are another way that the breast can be screened for breast cancer. And they actually seem to be even more sensitive than mammograms at picking up cancers. The problem with applying that to the general population is that they are so sensitive that they're somewhat oversensitive, and so there are many false positives if we use MRIs for screening. If we did it in the general population, it's estimated that about 1 out of 4 women would be sent for a biopsy, often turning out to be something insignificant, but having to go through the anxiety and the procedure of a biopsy. So where we recommend it is in the very highest risk women, and that is most definitively recommended for women who carry some of the known genes that predispose to hereditary breast cancer, and those genes also predispose to early onset breast cancer at an earlier than average age. In addition, that very young age is just the age group where mammograms are less effective, because younger women have much denser breasts, which can hide cancer within the dense breast tissue, or also lead to false positives because of just naturally dense tissue in the breasts.
Now, Mike, just a question for our listeners out there. You know, is screening mammography covered by, you know, all insurance?
It is. Mammograms are absolutely covered by insurance companies, and for almost all of them on an annual basis.
So for those who, say, may not have insurance, may not have coverage, and need a mammogram, are there support services that would allow them to receive those mammograms?
Many communities have things like screening vans that can go around to places of employment and offer very inexpensive mammographic screening. Anyone who's concerned and doesn't have insurance should ask their doctor or their local cancer center and find out about that.
Mike, on a different topic, for women that are at high risk, are there any interventions, any medicines that they can take that will reduce their risk?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So just identifying risk isn't enough. And of course, screening can catch a cancer early, but as you're alluding to, we'd rather prevent it than even having to catch it early. Mm-hmm. And there are essentially two ways that the risk of developing breast cancer can be prevented. One is surgical and one is with medicine. So for some women who know that they are at extremely high risk of developing breast cancer, for example, some of the genetically inherited syndromes can give a woman an 85% chance of developing breast cancer sometime in their life. And some of those women will choose to have prophylactic surgery, prophylactically having a bilateral mastectomy to reduce the risk of breast cancer. There is a medical intervention that's not quite as effective, but also somewhat effective, and that's a medicine that can be used to lower the risk of breast cancer. And this actually arose because we realized we use this medicine to treat breast cancer, and we realized that when we use it to treat breast cancer, it reduced the odds of getting a breast cancer in the opposite breast from the one that we were treating. Mm-hmm. And so that medication was called tamoxifen. And just in the past year, we have had an additional study that has shown that another medication that's actually used to treat osteoporosis, which is a cousin of tamoxifen, and it's called raloxifen, or Evista is the brand name. And that, like tamoxifen, can also reduce the risk of developing breast cancer. And these medications seem to reduce the risk by about 50%. So they're not a guarantee, but for someone at high risk, that's a big chunk of risk that can be eliminated.
And Mike, how do these two medicines work to reduce the risk of a woman developing breast cancer?
These medications are actually what we call anti-estrogens, and that leads to the connection between estrogen, the female sex hormone, and breast cancer. So estrogen is the female sex hormone, and that is what essentially makes girls girls. And the parts of the body that contain what's called the estrogen receptor will grow in response to estrogen. estrogen. And the normal breast tissue contains estrogen receptor. And that's the reason why when a little girl hits puberty and her estrogen levels go up, she will grow breasts. And that doesn't happen to a boy because boys don't have that surge of estrogen at puberty. When a breast cancer arises in the breast, at least half the time the cancer also contains the estrogen receptor. And if that's the case, then the cancer requires estrogen to grow, and the cancer is fed by estrogen. And so one way that we treat these types of breast cancers is with these anti-estrogen drugs like tamoxifen. And the mechanism of tamoxifen reducing the risk of developing breast cancer in the first place is exactly the same thing by antagonizing estrogen in a woman's breast.
Mike, I know that you do some wonderful laboratory research on breast cancer, and we're going to get more into it in the second part of the show, but for women where the tumor is not sensitive to estrogen, what seems to be fueling the cancer in that case?
So there's at least one other broad class of type of breast cancer, and that's the type of breast cancer that contains a different receptor, and that receptor is called HER2. And this type of receptor is a little bit different, but it picks up signals from the bloodstream to help the cancer to grow. And for those types of cancer, it's about 20 or 25% of all breast cancers that have an abundance of HER2 receptor. There is a new, very effective therapy for helping to treat those cancers and to reduce the risk of relapsing, and that therapy is known as Herceptin. And just in the last year, for patients with advanced cancer that have HER2, there's a second drug that also works at the HER2 receptor, and that can work after Herceptin has stopped working.
I also wanted to ask you, too, I guess some of your research is on insulin, an insulin growth factor. How does that play in into the worry about breast cancer?
Yeah, so that's another type of receptor, and this is not at all yet really in the realm of treating patients with breast cancer. This is still really laboratory research and very early clinical trials. But there's another receptor known as the insulin-like growth factor receptor. And experiments that were done 15 or 20 years ago in the laboratory showed that if you have cells that don't have this receptor, you can't turn them cancerous. So it's a very critical receptor in cancer being cancer. And there are drugs that are just coming through the pipeline from some of the pharmaceutical companies that can specifically inhibit this receptor. And as you alluded to in my laboratory research, these types of drugs can really complement some of the types of drugs that we use now, such as tamoxifen and Herceptin. So maybe one day in the near future, we might have a clinical trial ready to test that type of treatment.
Mike, in addition to, you know, the new medicines that you've just talked about in terms of trying to either prevent the breast cancer from happening or reduce the risk of the breast cancer from returning, are there any other lifestyle and or dietary changes that can be made to try to also reduce the potential risk?
Yeah, so some of the lifestyle factors related to breast cancer are one that I alluded to earlier is the age at which a woman bears her first child and whether or not she breastfeeds. So a woman who has her first child before age 24 significantly reduces her risk of developing breast cancer. On the other hand, a woman who never has a baby or has a baby later in life, for example, after age 35 or 40, that can actually increase the risk of breast cancer. Now, this isn't a very modifiable type of risk factor because it's hard for us to go into the public and start telling women in their young 20s that they should all run out and have a baby as quickly as they can. So that's not very modifiable. But some of the factors that might perhaps be modifiable are that it seems that perhaps exercise and a low-fat diet might reduce the risk of developing breast cancer. In some very interesting recent research, a low-fat diet may also help a woman who has had breast cancer from relapsing. And that's something that's of interest as well.
Well, we'd like to remind you to email your questions to canceranswers@yale.edu. We're going to take a short break for a medical minute, and then please stay tuned to learn more information about breast cancer with Dr. Michael DiGiovanna from the Yale Cancer Center.
You know, there are over 10 million cancer survivors in the U.S., and the numbers keep growing. Completing treatment for cancer is a very exciting milestone, but cancer and its treatment can be a life-changing experience. Following treatment, the return to normal activities and relationships can be difficult, and cancer survivors may face other long-term side effects of cancer, including heart problems, osteoporosis, fertility issues, and an increased risk of second cancers. Resources for cancer survivors are available, though, at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the Yale Cancer Center, to keep cancer survivors well and focused on healthy living. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Ed Chu, and Dr. Michael DiGiovanna, discussing treatment for breast cancer. Mike, we finished the first segment talking a little bit about what happens after breast cancer in terms of reducing risk and of recurrence. Can you say a little bit more about that? It's an important topic.
In terms of the treatment for it or the...
Well, no, in terms of lifestyle.
Yeah, so one of the things I mentioned was that some recent studies have shown that women who adopt a very low-fat diet after their treatment of breast cancer can reduce their risk of relapsing with the breast cancer. And we actually expected that this would most affect the women who have the estrogen receptor positive types of breast cancer because we know that estrogen can come from fat. So if you can reduce your fat intake and lose weight, we thought it might reduce the risk of relapsing for the women with the estrogen receptor positive type of breast cancer. And as in science, we are always surprised, the result actually showed that it was more of an effect in the women with estrogen receptor negative breast cancer. And this is important because they don't have the anti-estrogen drugs as further protection like the estrogen receptor positive women do. And so it's postulated that this effect of fat reducing the estrogen receptor negative cancers from relapsing could be related to what we were speaking about a few minutes ago, which is insulin-like growth factor that also is related to diet.
And I guess other nutritional factors that would be important to reduce the risk would be, you know, fruits, vegetables, you know, the ACS, NCI recommendation, you know, to have at least five different servings of fruits, vegetables, high fiber, low fat,
yeah,
really kind of work.
Those are
here.
Recommendations from the NCI, as you mentioned, that may help to reduce the risk of cancer in general. How potent the effect is specifically at breast cancer is still not very clear, but certainly advisable for reducing one's risk of breast cancer, or of any type of cancer, as well as general health in other areas.
Right. And I think as we've talked about on the show before, I mean, good, you know, healthy lifestyle to prevent the risk of cardiovascular disease, cerebrovascular disease. So it's just good things for our listeners out there to pay attention to.
That's right. Some recent research has also suggested perhaps that a very important period of life in terms of the diet and exercise might actually be in the teenage years, impacting the risk of developing breast cancer later on in life.
Mike, there's a large audience of out there of women and their families, women who've had breast cancer. When you see a new patient with breast cancer who, let's say, has had a lumpectomy and been found to have breast cancer, what are the features, the factors that you look at in terms of her risk of recurrence? And then as a follow-up, we'll get into in a couple minutes, you know, what to do about that risk. But how do you assess it?
So typically, our best predictors historically to determine what someone's prognosis was, meaning what are their odds of relapsing in the future, even though they appear to be cancer-free after their surgery, were based on how many lymph nodes in the armpit had contained cancer. That is the first place that the cancer spreads to generally is the lymph nodes in the armpit. And the second most important feature, the size of the tumor. These are very crude ways of looking at a cancer and determining how big is it and how many lymph nodes has it spread to. Although, as more research is done, we're getting a little bit smarter, and it's probably more the biology of each individual tumor, and we're just learning now how to look more at the biology than simply measuring the size, which is a very crude way to look at things.
But typically, once surgery has been performed, you know, what are the general recommendations for follow-up therapy?
Yeah, so let me emphasize that the cure rate for breast cancer has been increasing, and it's been increasing for two reasons. One is the one we talked about earlier, which is early detection, because the earlier that it's detected, the less likelihood that it will ever relapse, so therefore the higher the cure rate. But the other reason why the cure rate is going up is more and more effective adjuvant therapies. So let me say a little bit about adjuvant therapy. Adjuvant therapy is the woman that is the treatment that a woman might receive after the surgeon has completely removed the tumor and she appears to be cancer-free. The concept is that there's always some chance that some cancer could be left behind in the body, that some microscopic little bits of cancer from the tumor could have gotten into the bloodstream and traveled throughout the body and be hiding in other places in the body, even though they're completely undetectable at the time of the diagnosis and the surgery because they're not causing symptoms, you can't find them when you examine a patient, and they're too small even to show up on our most sophisticated types of scans. But we take our best guess at judging what the odds are that there might be some cancer left behind using things like I said, the lymph node status and the size of the tumor. And then we decide if we should give adjuvant treatment, which is some kind of medicines, medical treatment, after the surgery in attempt to eradicate any of these tiny little microscopic pieces of the cancer that could be hiding anywhere else in the body to prevent a woman from ever relapsing from the rest of her life. And that's critically important because if relapses occur in other parts of the body, that defines stage 4 breast cancer. That is the definition of metastases. Metastasis is a tumor growing in some other part of the body because it spread from its original place. And almost always, stage 4 or metastatic breast cancer, like many other cancers, is almost always incurable. And so the best goal for cure is to prevent that with some adjuvant treatments after the surgery.
Mike, I know one of the main concerns expressed by women with breast cancer who are facing, you know, the possibility for receiving adjuvant therapy or the potential side effects associated with the treatments. Can you comment on that?
Yes. So in the case of breast cancer, there are three potential types of medicines used for this adjuvant therapy to prevent relapses. For those women who have tumors that contain the estrogen, we know that estrogen is very important for feeding the cancers, and therefore the most effective therapy actually is the anti-estrogen pills like tamoxifen or some other newer ones that postmenopausal women can take. So for estrogen receptor positive tumors, anti-estrogens are the mainstay of treatment. For those tumors that we talked about that are the HER2-expressing tumors, the HER2-positive tumors, the medication we talked about, Herceptin, is very effective at reducing the risk of breast cancer. And for all other types of cancers, and sometimes in addition to these treatments, we use what's considered conventional chemotherapy. So it's the kind of chemotherapy that can be used to treat any other type of cancer. And chemotherapy is associated generally with more side effects than things like the anti-estrogen treatments or the Herceptin treatment. And many people who've experienced friends or family members going through cancer treatment with chemotherapy are familiar with some of these side effects, such as hair loss, nausea, low blood counts. But we have other medicines that actually can effectively counterbalance some of these side effects. So, for example, we have excellent anti-nausea medications so that is not an issue like it was 15 or 20 years ago. We have medications that can prevent the blood counts from getting too low. So we have ways to counteract some of these side effects. But chemotherapy, obviously, is the more difficult of the treatments to go through compared to the others.
But I think, you know, you raise a very important point, Mike, and that is really over the last 5 to 10 years, you know, we've developed much greater supportive measures to be able to support our patients through their chemotherapy treatments.
Exactly. And this is what we call, as you alluded to, supportive care. Care in preventing the side effects of treatment, helping them get through treatment. Sometimes we need to adjust the dose of the chemotherapy. Sometimes we need to delay a treatment to give an extra week to recuperate from any possible side effects from the prior treatment before that. And so one of the true advances in treating cancer that's not so obvious because it doesn't hit the front page of the newspaper is how much better we've gotten at supportive care, helping people to get through their chemotherapy treatments as gently as possible.
Mike, you know, I think when people picture someone receiving chemotherapy, they, you know, they picture a person being very sick and very ill. So I just want to ask you, on a day-to-day basis, you know, when women come in and are getting adjuvant therapy, preventative therapy, you know, what's the feeling like in the clinic for them with the nurses? Is it a somber event, or, you know, what's that like?
Yeah, so let me preface the answer by saying that there are different types of chemotherapy, and even within one type of cancer, such as breast cancer, there are different chemotherapy programs that we choose depending on the specifics of the individual case. And different people may be susceptible to different side effects even when they're treated with the identical chemotherapy. But for the most part, people are able to go on their daily business and do everything that they normally do. Most of my patients who are getting adjuvant chemotherapy, if they were working before their treatment, they continue to work full time if they would like to during all of their chemotherapy treatments. My favorite story that I like to tell my patients when they're just beginning is a woman that I had who was in her young 40s, and she was an athlete. She was on a very competitive volleyball team, and throughout her entire course of chemotherapy, she never missed a game.
which is a great testimonial to people's resilience, to the supportive care, and to a good doctor, too.
Thanks.
Just want to share that. When a patient comes to a center like Yale or to another breast center, can you tell us a little bit about what does multidisciplinary care mean?
Yeah, so for many cancers, we're realizing that the optimal way to treat it really involves different types of specialists. At a minimum, for something like breast cancer, that would involve a surgeon who does the surgery, a medical oncologist such as myself who gives any adjuvant treatments and also kind of becomes the quarterback of the team, and in many cases, radiation treatments that supplement the treatment. And the most common reason in breast cancer is women who don't have a mastectomy but are able to have a lumpectomy and keep their breast need radiation to the breast just to ensure that there is all the cancer that was in the breast won't come back. And so more and more, we are working together in teams of the different specialists. And this is what we refer to as multidisciplinary care for cancer. In addition, I have described how we give the adjuvant medical treatments after the surgery. We are now sometimes giving the adjuvant medical treatments before the surgery to shrink the tumor first before the surgeon goes to remove it to optimize the surgery. And obviously, that requires very close coordination between the different doctors who are involved in the care. And so this is what we mean by the multidisciplinary approach to treating cancer.
And I guess I might actually include two other members of that team who probably also play very critical roles, and that's the radiologist and the pathologist.
Right. So these are the more behind-the-scenes people, but the radiologist who is reading the mammograms or the MRIs or the ultrasounds and informing us exactly what the extent of the tumor is and which surgery we might need to do, the pathologist who is telling us what type of cancer it is and doing all the tests on it and which receptors are present, as well as other people of the team, such as genetics doctors who sometimes are involved when it seems to be a genetically inherited cancer, and the results sometimes of the genetic tests come into the decision making as to what type of treatment the patient is going to have or going to choose.
And again, also here at the Yale Cancer Center, I think we pride ourselves on having social workers also play a very active and integral role.
Social workers, chemotherapy nurses, nurse practitioners, and research nurses for those of our patients who are involved in some of our research treatments as well.
So it's a really big village.
Well, I want to add, and I'll put a little plug in here for the Cancer Survivorship Program.
There you go. Absolutely.
Which is important in terms of follow-up care. Well, Mike, I want to thank you for joining us for Yale Cancer Center Answers.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
Mike, this has been a terrific session as always, and we look forward to having you on a future show to hear more about all the great things that are going on in the breast cancer world. Until next week, this is Dr. Ed Chu.
And Dr. Ken Miller.
From the Yale Cancer Center, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions, comments, or would like to subscribe to our podcast, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you'll also find transcripts of past broadcasts in written form. Next week, Ed Chu speaks with Louis Denny. He's the Director of Clinical Research and Development at Pfizer Oncology.